This is Partially Excited, a podcast all about the world of disabilities and we, the people who live within it. Our lives, dreams, accessibility challenges, family life, medical help, reflections, and voices of living people who live disabled on a daily basis. It is a show of overcoming, of faith, of agonies, and triumph. It is a podcast for you. Here's your host, Aaron O'Dowd.
Partially Excited.
Hello and welcome. On today's show, we have Stuart Lawler. He is a colleague of the National Council of the Blind. He also has a visual impairment and attended Rosmini School in Dublin, which is a school that caters to vision impaired and blind. He also was part of Child Vision. That's correct. Hello and welcome to the show, Stuart. How are you doing today?
I'm absolutely fine. Thank you, Aaron. Thanks for having me. It's very nice to be with you on your Partially Excited podcast.
Ah, excellent. Stuart, tell us a small bit about how you came to knowing about your visual impairment.
Well, my vision impairment is, I'm one of the very small percentage of people who have total blindness. So I don't have light perception. I don't have any of that. My eye condition is one called retinoblastoma. That's a cancerous tumor behind the eye. So in my case, it was on the optic nerve, growing on the optic nerve and moving towards the brain. So when I was 7 or 8 weeks old, there was a follow-up medical appointment found that my eyes weren't reacting to any sort of stimulus. So they did some further tests and discovered the tumor. And at that time, in the mid-70s, the only way to get rid of the tumor was to cut the optic nerve and to remove the eye. So they did that with the right eye first. And then at 11 weeks, they discovered that the left eye was also going to be compromised by the tumor on the left side of the optic nerve. So they had to sever that as well. But, you know, the alternative would have been a brain tumor, which obviously would have been much worse. And I suppose it is a form of cancer. So they got it early. It did mean total sight loss. But from my perspective, I've never had it. So it's not such a huge thing.
Was that when you were really young or through your childhood?
No, I was the first eye was removed at 8 weeks, the second eye at 11 weeks, so I don't remember any of it.
Did you find it strange growing up?
I don't know that I found it strange. I mean, I've always considered myself just, I happen to be blind. I use the term blind. I'm not very politically correct, I suppose. In that sense, I think sometimes we get so worried about language. So for me growing up, I was blind, but I was a normal kid like anyone else, and I was treated. I have twin sisters, and they're a couple of years younger than me, and they're fully sighted. And we had a busy house growing up, and I was treated the same. I suppose my schooling, as you mentioned at the start of the piece, there I went to what at the time was called St. Joseph's. It's now, as you said, it's now called Child Vision. That was a residential boarding school. I don't think that would have happened nowadays, obviously, because there's so much more mainstreaming going on. But again, in 1980, when I was starting in school, mainstreaming was just not really heard of. It was so difficult. And I come from a small area in County Kildare, quite a rural area. The local school was a two-teacher school. It would have been really difficult, I think, to support a totally blind child in that type of environment.
So did you attend St. Joseph's / Child Vision at primary school or secondary school?
For primary and secondary. So primary is and in fact, this is still the case, you're in the specialised on-campus primary school, which just caters for people with impaired vision, and now, I suppose, for people with multiple disabilities. And there's all sorts of great stuff that they do now. And then in secondary school, you go into the integrated community school called Rosmini. And that's kind of interesting, I always think, because I still think it's a very funny time to integrate kids at 12 or 13 on both sides, because you're suddenly plunged into a class of fully sighted teenagers who have probably never been introduced to a blind person before. And they see this couple of blind people coming in, and they're not really sure what to do, and you're not really sure what to do. So I don't know that model actually works. There are differing views on it, I suppose. But, I think the model of mainstreaming from primary is probably better, if you can do that.
What would your ideal opinion be of education system for vision impairs?
Well, first of all, there's no doubt in my mind that I would have got the education I had if I hadn't gone to Child Vision. So for me at the time, and as I said a few minutes ago, in 1980, the only option was special ed. And I got great stuff there. And I suppose, in terms of, you know, things that certainly I feel very passionate about still for kids who are blind. Learning Braille, it's just it's a skill. Learning to, you know, travel safely, the mobility stuff. There are things that are harder to get, but they're key skills. So if you can have a situation now in a mainstream environment or in a special ed where all those skills are there, plus now we have obviously access to all sorts of technology, and technology has opened the doors for so many people with impaired vision on a whole range of things in education and in the workplace. And that's really good, you know.
You said you went to school in the 80s, and looking today with all the technology, are you pea green of what you could have at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, yes, I mean, look, you look at the technology now and you say, wow, if I had that when I was back. I mean, I did my leaving cert in 1993 on a manual typewriter. Because we weren't, and there was computers then. We had word processing, we had speech synthesis, we had synthetic speech. That was all there. But you weren't allowed to use it in the exam because the Department of Education at the time just didn't allow it. Now, of course, everyone's using their technology, and it's as it should be. You know, it's difficult enough being blind or having any kind of disability without additional barriers, without needless barriers being put up in your way. Yeah, I would have loved to have loads of the stuff that we have now. But, you know, I think kids who are coming through the system now, and if they have the right support, it can be really good. And I suppose in my professional life now, I get to support some of that and to work with people in that environment. And it's fantastic.
After you finished your state exams to go on to third level education, what did you do after that?
So when I finished my leaving cert, I was kind of as lots of people finish their leaving cert when you have a disability or not, I was in this sort of dilemma of not sure what I wanted to do. I was always interested in doing something with music. So I had applied to a couple of colleges. I applied to Maynooth and I applied to University College Cork. And I got called for an interview for UCC in April of that year. And I went to that and they did an interview for me and they kind of, with me, and they kind of said, the result will depend, you know, on your points and your leaving cert as well. So I did the leaving cert in June and I didn't get the first round of offers. I got called in the second round. So it was really tight in early September when I got called and told I had a place in college. And I started in UCC studying music. It's a 4-year degree. And I started that in beginning of October. 1993.
Before you did this course in UCD, was music your passion?
Yeah, I suppose I always enjoyed, I mean, I play piano, not as much as I'd like nowadays, but I play piano and I always enjoyed doing that. So I was interested to study it, although I knew I would never be a concert piano player or something like that. But while I was in college, interestingly, I suppose I developed a real interest in sound engineering. I was always interested in technology, but I developed a real interest in sound engineering and in how technology and music worked together. And I suppose how people with impaired vision could use that technology. And this was when I finished 1997, 98, there was lots of exciting things happening with technology. Windows 95 had been released 2 years at this stage. With all this technology coming on stream, but there was all these glitches in it because it didn't all tweak together. So there was all these accessibility problems. And I realized that I couldn't use a lot of the tools in terms of, say, music production or audio production that would be used out there in the mainstream, in the record industry, let's say, or the music industry, because they weren't accessible. So I kind of never went there after doing my music degree. I became more interested in technology and supporting people to use technology. And I've always enjoyed supporting people to learn about technology because I realized that if you use it, you don't have to be a geek. You don't have to know how it works, but you do need to know how to make it work for you. And I think that's the difference.
Did you find it difficult doing the music with not being able to see the notes or the instruments?
No, it's a good question. No, piano lends itself very well to someone who's blind anyway. But, you know, I again, and this is another one of my things I like to talk to people about. I mean, I learned in school to read Braille music. I don't believe you can fully enjoy a music degree without, as a blind person, without reading Braille music. Now, there are people who've done it and who would disagree with that. But certainly for me, I wanted to be able to at least read some of the stuff that we were studying. I know you won't always do it all. So I had some stuff available in Braille. I learned piano throughout my time in UCC, mainly by ear. and got some material in Braille as well. So it's always interesting because you have to balance sometimes the enjoyment or the this idea of having all this access with the actual practicalities of carrying all this Braille around with you, and how long is it going to take me to read this music, and do I actually need, is it going to enhance my knowledge that much if I have read it? So they're all the things you try to weigh up as you go along.
I want to talk about Braille, but I want to ask you this question before we talk about Braille.
Sure.
What does the music notes in Braille look like when you feel it?
Well, they actually, if you looked at them, you would think they are Braille, because without going into this in too much detail, because we'd really confuse your listeners, I don't want to do that. Music notes in Braille are symbols that look just like Braille letters. And the music, the way it works is in what we would call standard English Braille, the letter D in standard English Braille is the note C in music Braille. So you have to do a little bit of converting in your head. And when people learn the beginning, it's really complicated, but it does work and it's a great system.
As a Braille reader, you must find it complicated to memorize the numbers, letters, music notes, and etc. How do you go about it?
Well, I suppose I've been a Braille reader all my life. I've been a Braille reader for whatever, since the late 70s. So it's sort of second nature to me now. I don't read as much Braille music now as I used to. In fact, I'd go weeks without reading Braille music. I read English Braille every day. But Braille is so, it just fits. It comes natural. It's like someone picking up a print book and just looking at it, you know. It's something you've learned. And when people learn Braille later in life, it's a significantly more of a challenge. And it's, people often equate it to learning a language. It's a big, big undertaking for people.
Can you give a simple example of what Braille is if anyone hasn't seen it?
Yeah, Braille, absolutely. Braille is a series of raised dots that allow blind people to communicate, to read and write. It was developed by a gentleman named Louis Braille in France in the early 1800s. And he was blinded in an accident in his father's workshop. And actually, one of the interesting things is he actually developed the Braille music code as well, because he was a musician and he was an organist. So he developed Braille music and he developed the Braille alphabet. There were other variants before Louis Braille. There was a guy called Charles Barbier who developed a kind of a tactile reading system that soldiers used to use at night when the lights were out and they didn't want to be, you know, they couldn't turn on lights to draw attention to themselves. These guys were at war, but they wanted to be able to read. And this guy, Charles Barbier, developed something. And I suppose Louis Braille took that and probably cleaned it up a bit, I suppose.
The way we see Kindles and we see the iBook app and the iPod and various e-readers, do you think Braille will disappear like print?
Well, that's always a danger. I sincerely, passionately hope not. And one of the things that we in NCBI are doing, and one of the things that lots of organisations and individuals as well are doing, is lobbying for Braille literacy and for support in Braille education. I think it's the same. You could say the same about a Kindle, like, oh, everyone's reading Kindles. Will people stop picking up print books? And one thing you hear a lot of people say who enjoy reading, I know someone who, she just loves to go to bookshops and just browse. She could be there for hours picking up books. You'll never get that with technology. So I hope these things will always have a place. There is lots of technology-related Braille hardware and software as well. And that's brilliant, because it certainly, one of the disadvantages to Braille is it's so bulky, it takes up so much space. So the technology tools that allow us to use Braille are super.
Tell us about how you got involved with the National Council for the Blind.
When I was in college, I was very interested to see how people use technology. And because I was already using technology, I ended up being called upon to assist some other students who were visually impaired. I thoroughly enjoyed doing that and realized this is kind of interesting. And after that, I was working with a company for a year who were selling products for the blind into Ireland and Northern Ireland. In fact, most of the work was in Northern Ireland, so I was doing a lot of work in Northern Ireland. For me, it was a very, very interesting job, but it was an awful lot of travel and it was very sales focused. And I sort of realized it wasn't really me. So in the interim, then I took a job, a short-term contract in Trinity College, where I worked as the disability assistive technology officer working out of the disability service. And that was very interesting, but that ended. And I had been in touch with NCBI before, and they at the time were looking for people to come in and do telephone technical support. So myself and another guy started pretty much on the same day. And the other person, whose name is Paul Trainer, was an awful lot better than me. And he's still there as a tech support officer. I went into management and went on to do other things in NCBI. But he's a key person in the organization because he has a huge amount of knowledge and is one of the most patient people you could meet. So when we started in NCBI, we were supporting all these users who had just got technology for the first time. And, you know, this is way before people had iPhones and all this stuff was built in. And it was a lot of, you know, connecting things together and making sure everything was connected in so it would work. And if you installed the wrong thing, it would crash. And it was all very, and there was very, very little internet, of course. So people couldn't get online very easily. We didn't have things like Skype, which obviously we're talking on now. So it was all very different.
You said that you were interested working in Trinity College. What made you interested in that kind of work?
Probably because when I had been in UCC in Cork supporting students, and a job in Trinity College came up then, and I was doing a lot of traveling for my other job at the time, and I kind of said, I want a job where I'm not traveling all the time. Because I was living in Dublin, but I was spending 4 or 5 days every 2 weeks going to Northern Ireland. I applied for that and I got it. And working in the disability service in there was sort of like some of the work I'd done in UCC, but it was also much broader because we were working with people with, say, dyslexia and dyspraxia and all sorts of other, you know, other things who needed technology to support them. So I had to learn very quickly about a whole load of new technology that I've never come across before and never really have since either, by the way. So that was kind of an interesting learning curve.
So we're at the point where technology is starting to come out and you're at the NCBI. With the curve of technology, did you kind of say, wow, this is what's going to happen? Or are you just kind of expecting?
It's a good question. I mean, I think sometimes what happens with people, I suppose, like myself, I suppose, you know, some of us who are working in this sector and see technology every day and see how it can work for people, that we can sometimes get a bit sort of, we can sometimes get a bit bored and say, God, what's happening here? What's happening with technology? What's going on? What's the next big innovation? And I think in the last 13 years, 14 years, there were probably two that hit me. The first was the talking phone. You know, back in, I think it was 2003, we started really seriously supporting this in NCBI. And they were Nokia handsets running an application called Talks, which was developed by two guys in Germany, one blind and one sighted. And this was revolutionary. This was just incredible that people could. And this was at the time when text messaging was at its peak. And one of those times when, and I don't know, Aaron, if you've been in these situations as a person who has low vision, maybe, when you're sitting having a coffee with somebody and you know the person isn't listening to you because they're looking at their phone and they're texting, and you felt quite left out of this. So this was when all this stuff was at its height. These guys came out with software that would make Nokia phones talk, and suddenly all this accessibility is here. That's the first thing. And the second thing actually is happened because of the first thing. The second thing is the launch, the development of accessibility in the iPhone, which came in 2009. Now, I firmly believe, good and all as Apple are, that that wouldn't have happened without what happened before it with the Nokia software, because I'm sure they saw it and got their ideas. And then, of course, Android has done that since with Google, and there's great accessibility there. Microsoft are definitely going in the right direction with Windows. So mobile platforms now, there is more choice. I mean, back in 2009, 2010, if you didn't have a Nokia, Nokias were becoming harder to get. If you needed an accessible phone, you pretty much had to get an iPhone. And I think still iPhone is probably the most consistent. But there are other choices out there now, which is always good.
Are you a technology nerd or anorak, or are you just a guy that's kind of riding the wave for accessibility?
I'm a technology nerd, but, you know, I love getting my hands on new technology. I'll try things to see if they work. I don't mind the rough edges of things because I want to get a first look at something. Obviously, accessibility is hugely important for everyone. And accessibility and usability, I think, go hand in hand. So something has to be usable. There's no good having something that's usable and not accessible. But there's equally no good having something that's fully accessible but not usable. You don't know how to use it because maybe it's too complicated. So there's a much greater awareness now amongst developers, whether that be website, app developers, vendors, makers of technology. So a good example of the, probably the most interesting in the last year is the Kindle Fire, the new Amazon Kindle Fire HD, selling for about 50 odd euros or a little more online, that out of the box, you can turn on speech and get a fully accessible tablet for 50 euros. We are in a very exciting time of change.
When Windows 95 was out, and was JAWS around at that time, or was it just in an incubator stage?
JAWS was around. Interestingly, JAWS wasn't the first screen reader I used. I used something for a while called Window Eyes, and there was something as well called Window Bridge. Now, Window Bridge is gone. Window Eyes is still around. Window Eyes is now going to be, it's called Fusion. It's built into ZoomText, which is a magnification package. But yeah, JAWS was around. I've been using JAWS since version 2. We're now in version 17. So I've seen it go through lots of stages. I've seen lots of innovations. I've seen sometimes where I felt there could have been more innovation. There's also free screen readers out there. There's a screen reader called NVDA, which stands for Non-Visual Desktop Access to Windows, because, you know, the other side of it is JAWS is expensive. Not everybody can afford JAWS. I think that will change. I think the pricing structure will change in the future, because the market now is so competitive, and this open source free screen reader is definitely giving JAWS a run for its money, and that's a good thing. So we're going to see in the next 3 years far more choice for consumers, for people who are buying technology. We're becoming much more aware of what we want, what we think we should have, and we're becoming far more aware that, you know, people are buying online now, people are comparing prices. And that's a really good thing, and that's going to be good for accessibility as well.
In your opinion, where do you think that awareness and choice comes from?
I think a certain amount of it is advocacy, you know, and there's no doubt if you look in the States, a certain amount of it is down to litigation. So people taking companies to court because something wasn't accessible. And that's good if it gets the right result. But I think a lot of it, to be fair, is just down to the fact that companies have realized that people with disabilities have spending power, and they're consumers, and they want the technology as badly as the next person. So I've been one of these people who's bought not every iPhone, by the way. I've bought some. I've bought two iPhones on the day of release here in Ireland, along with a whole rake of other people. But the only difference is I've happened to buy it and switched on VoiceOver, which is the screen reader. But I've had the same really good experience of using that device because it's fully accessible. And I think the reason it's fully accessible is because Apple realize there's a nice chunk of the market that they can get hold of who have spending power.
When you go out to meet friends or out to do jobs, do you use a long cane or a guide dog?
I use a long cane, and I suppose it's a very personal decision for people. I made a choice a long time ago to use a cane. I do love dogs, but I didn't want to have to manage a dog every day, look after it. It's a different relationship, I think. So I use the cane. I love it. I'm very happy with it. And again, for me, it's just about being comfortable with your mobility aid, being confident. I use some technology as well, so I use GPS on my phone, not all the time, but if occasionally, or if I'm in a new place, or if I'm traveling on a bus, for example, and I wonder where I am, I use GPS, and it's very handy for that. So that's another way that technology has connected us and allowed us to do all these things that we just couldn't do before.
Yeah, and do you think with the likes of Google Car, the cane would be kind of technology-wise down the road?
I'm dying for the Google Car.
Yeah, same here.
And I'm sure you are too. You know, the Google Car is interesting because if it does all that they say it will, and that everything we've read about it, you'll be taking out your phone and using your phone to unlock your car and getting in and starting the car and saying to the phone, bring me home, or bring me to Limerick, or wherever it is, and the car will drive you. But, you know, I think that I was reading something recently, and they said the biggest issue with the Google Car is not the Google Car. It's they have to then have a culture almost of getting drivers on the road. It's so the problem with the Google Car will be human error, other drivers' errors. Is the car going to be smart enough to be able to make a decision and do something if another car does something? So I suppose with that, we're probably a little bit away from actually driving these things. But, you know, who knows? Who knows what will happen in 15, 20 years from now.
And Stuart, what is your pet peeve about not being able to see?
I don't have too many. I probably have some. I think just things like, I don't think anyone does things to be absolutely awkward, but people leaving bins out in the middle of roads, or parking on footpaths, or restaurants that have tables outside and signs out at the front of the table on very narrow paths. And of course, the problem for the restaurant is it's summertime, everyone wants to sit outside, and they have a right to put stuff on their paths, but it just creates huge problems. So there's a certain amount of public awareness, there's a certain amount of advocacy that you can do for that, to sort of say to people, look, this is why it's not a good idea to park a car on a path. This is, and I think if you make that broader, so not just saying to people, a blind person might hit that. What about saying to somebody, how would somebody with a buggy manage there? So you broaden it out. I think that's important.
By using the cane, have you had any serious accidents that kind of think, oh, wow, I need to brush up my skills, or maybe think about getting a guide dog?
I've had instances where I've sort of said, you know something, that was my own fault, so I was walking too fast. I've had instances where, for example, it might be raining and there is a lot of, actually that's another thing, there's a lot of overhanging branches coming out of over people's railings, so you're going to get wet. So you try to walk on the outside of the path and you're walking too fast and you hit into a pole. It's those kind of things. I've never had any, touch wood, like I've heard of people having incidents where they've fallen down holes, you know, maybe a manhole that wasn't properly fenced off, and they're much more serious because they can cause major injury, you know.
Yeah, no, it's amazing how so simple can cause a huge accident like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Tell us about how your technology podcast show came about.
Oh, yeah. So the technology podcast that we produce in NCBI, it's around sometime early 2012. I was listening to, because I'm always listening to podcasts and finding out what's going on, particularly technology related. I've been listening to some of yours as well, by the way. They're very good. But trying to find out what's going on. And I realized there was a load of good stuff out there, but we were missing something with an Irish slant and missing hearing about some of the stuff, not just that NCBI was doing with technology, but to give people who are users of technology in Ireland a voice. So I went to the then CEO of NCBI, and sort of put it to him, and he said, let's try it for 3 months. And I think he very wisely said, let's try it for 3 months, because his worry was that it could be really successful, but then it's hard to stop something that's successful. And then somebody's left, i.e. me, left doing all the splicing and editing and production. But anyway, we launched in June 2012. Here we are in almost August 2016, and going strong. And we've had an episode every month since then. And the podcast is driven a lot by listener comments, listener feedback, and it's been amazing. There was two things, I suppose. First of all, the number of people outside Ireland who tuned in, and secondly, the number of services who picked us up and carried us outside of Ireland on their network. So there's a big service in the States called Zero Talk. And they have a Zero Talk, they have an app called iBlink Radio, which connects a whole range of blindness resources all around the world. And we didn't ask them to carry us on it. Somebody emailed me to tell me we're on Zero Talk. And we're in the iTunes podcast directory, and then a couple of radio services who feed off iTunes have carried us as well. So people don't have to look too hard to find the NCBI Technology Podcast. And if people want to look at us on the web, you can get us at www.ncbi.ie/technology podcast. And you can read, you know, the last 15 or 16 months worth of shows and the show notes, and you can listen to the shows from that page as well.
When you had this idea, was it the guy who wants to make a really cool podcast, or a guy who wants to discover technology?
Possibly both. I mean, I think if you're going to do something, if you're podcasting now, you have to do it. Quality has to be good. And if you're producing something, it has your name on it, you want to make sure it's good. And I think, well, at least I hope, that the reason our listenership is still so high is because people are enjoying what we're putting out. We don't get it right all the time. There's some stuff that some people aren't interested in. But my key thing is to produce high-quality content and to have a high-quality, snappy 50, 55, 60-minute show with people at the start of every month. And if I can do that, then I'm pretty happy.
Do you do the recordings in the NCBI offices or home, or what's your setup?
No, I do my, what I call my field recordings, pretty much everywhere. Some of those are in NCBI if I'm meeting people there. Some of them are out and about. And then I have a little studio at home. So that's where all the inserting gets done, and some of the recordings get done here as well, and the splicing and post-production and the finalizing of the podcast. So that all happens. In fact, as you and I have this chat, we're on the end of July. So this weekend, I'll be finalizing the August podcast, which we'll be putting live on the NCBI website early next week, probably Monday or Tuesday.
Just describe to us about your mini setup, like what mic do you use, what production software do you use, etc.
Sure. So I have an 8-channel mixer. It's a Samson, not like the phones. It's Samson. I have a 2 or 3. I think they're one Shure mic, I think, and one Behringer. And then I use an application on my computer called SoundForge to do my editing and my production. And there are other applications that can do that. There's Reaper, there's Audacity. On the Mac side, there's GarageBand, there's Amadeus Logic. But for me, I find SoundForge meets my needs. And again, I've been using it for years and I'm very comfortable with it.
The reason why you chose this is because it's accessible with JAWS or a screen reader, or is it just something that fit into you?
I chose it because, it was the first audio editor I was introduced to. I can't even remember who introduced me to it. And, it was accessible with JAWS, and I realized that's the one for me.
Throughout the years of technology, what stands out in your mind to the software side? You've talked about the accessibility for the hardware. But where do you think the software world is going?
The software world is kind of interesting, isn't it? Because we're becoming more subscription-based than actually buying software. You know, it's very rarely now you'll buy something and you get a physical disc and a manual. You know, you get a download link with a code to license the product, and then you go online and read the manual. And of course, companies now are cutting down on all this shipment and printing pages and pages of stuff. They're still writing the documentation, they're just not printing it. I suppose in terms of software, the future is apps. You know, obviously screen reading software and technology on PC and Mac, it's all still there. It continues to mature, and I suppose it continues to respond to mainstream changes. So, for example, something like Microsoft Office 2016, that software is always growing, and there'll be new things. We have a Windows 10 anniversary update, they're calling it, coming, I think, this weekend sometime. It's a big update. JAWS is going to be ready to work with that, as are other screen readers. So, that's what's happening in the software end. But I think, as I say, it's apps that are exciting. It's people doing really interesting things with apps to help people. GPS, barcode, taking pictures of something. So if you have something in your cupboard, your 3 tins, and you're wondering, is it peas, beans, and spaghetti maybe? And you say, I wonder which tin is which. You want to open the wrong tin, you can use your phone's camera to take a picture, and the app goes off and processes it and comes back and tells you. And some of those are using processing, and some of them are using what's called crowdsourcing, which is people, volunteers out in the world who just help and say, that is a tin of peas. And, you know, and that's brilliant to see.
Yeah, it is. I only recently discovered Be My Eyes on the iPhone app, and it was amazing how it's a great little resource that's out there.
So Be My Eyes is another great app, and again, the only thing I think about some of these projects is they rely on volunteers because everybody's busy and because everyone does. People are busy with other things. Sometimes volunteers will fall off. So I think apps like Be My Eyes are great. I just hope they will have the longevity, I suppose, and that they can continue because they're vitally important. There's no substitute. You know, technology is great, but there's no substitute for talking to a human.
Do you have your top 5 or top 10 apps that you use on a regular basis on your phone?
Yeah, I do. Some of them, let's see, I'm just mentally trying to go through my phone, my home screens. So in my travel folder, I have my Dublin Bus app, which is very good. I have the Irish Rail app, I have the Lewis, I have Ryanair, that app is becoming more accessible. I have Aer Lingus, I have the Apple Maps app, which is really good. And then in my media app folder, I have the RTE Player, I have the RTE News, I have the BBC Player, I have an app called The Journal, which is a news source, very good app. And then in my social networks, I suppose I have Facebook and Twitter, obviously. And again, good accessibility generally across the board for those apps too.
With your work at NCBI, with new clients coming in, they just understanding their disability of what they can and can't do, how do you go about that to kind of introduce the technology side to them?
I suppose the way in which NCBI is working with people now is an assessment of need. And it's very much, it's a two sides process in that the person is a key, or the person is the key. The person is leading this. We're there to follow it. So when you're working with somebody for training, you're identifying the things that they can't do and the things that they would like to do. And you're looking a little bit into the future as well with people, because you're saying, well, where would you like to be at the end of this? And that could be using technology to find a job. It could be being able to travel independently so you can get to a job. Or it might just be being more confident locally to get out to the shops. And, you know, that's equally as important as somebody who wants to find a job, because who's to say that one person's needs are less important? So it's a process whereby you sit down with the person, and given that most people that NCBI work with have some degree of useful vision, and given that most people come to us later in life with reduced vision, one of the first conversations you're going to have with people is, what can you not do now that you were able to do earlier? And then you tease it back from there, and you talk about the things they have that they can do now that they can still do, and things that they find difficult, and things that they just are not able to do at all. And then you prioritize those in order of what the person feels is important to them.
If you could run that system through yourself, what would it be?
For me, the only thing, I suppose, that I really miss, now given that I've been blind all my life, so my answer would be slightly different. The one thing that I really miss is driving. I don't miss, because I've never done it, I suppose, properly. But the thing I wish I would like to be able to do is driving. So this is going back to our conversation a bit earlier about the Google car. That you know, maybe someday, who knows, we could all be driving our Google cars.
And you get frustrated with the struggles that you can't attempt to do?
I think at times I do. I think at times everyone does, but it's being able to step back from them, and if you can develop the frame of mind and say, well, here's all the things I can do. Here's the things that are great about living. Look, being blind is awkward sometimes. Having low vision is awkward, but being deaf is awkward, or having, you know, somebody maybe who can't walk very far. So everybody has things going on in their lives that they prefer not to have, but you work strategies to best overcome these things, I suppose. I think that's one of the key things.
If you could compare the services here and the UK, do you think there's a huge difference?
Well, I'm probably not best play. I mean, I can talk a bit about the UK, but there's two things, I suppose. First of all, the model is quite different, because here in Ireland, the state kind of would generally push services like mobility and technology training and kind of independent living stuff and employment support to agencies like NCBI, who they will give money to, and they will say to them, you do that. In the UK, it's a little different, because it's managed to some degree by local authorities and organisations like the RNIB in the UK, who are the kind of the equivalent of NCBI over here. They're much more involved in advocacy and lobbying, and they have a lot more time to do it. And of course, it's a bigger population. But I suppose just the second thing to say then is that what is happening in the UK, it's starting to happen here as well, and it happened a long time ago in places like Germany, is this idea of direct payments. So instead of the HSE funding a service to which you can tap in, you are given a budget, and you manage that budget, and you work out what your needs are. Now, you have to then go to me, for example, and say, how much will my technology training cost? And then you might say, well, actually, there's a guy down in Cork who's doing it cheaper. and that's kind of that model. Whether we'll actually see that in Ireland fully fledged in the years to come, I don't know. It's not perfect, because it assumes everybody is going to be able to manage budgets and bring in, you know, to sort of buy in services and make decisions around service quality. I don't know that that's going to happen, but it is occurring in the UK to some degree. And organizations then have to be flexible enough to be able to manage those changes, I think.
In your opinion, if you could look at the world systems regarding visual impairment and blindness, which do you think would be the best country to live in regarding services?
I'm not really sure. I was recently, a couple of weeks ago, I was at a conference in the States, in Baltimore, Maryland. And I was walking around with somebody, and we were commenting that there was no audible lights. There was no tactile paving. And most blind people moved around in taxis. Sometimes we're very quick to criticize Ireland. I think we do pretty well here. There's no doubt from what I've read, and indeed one or two things I've seen, that the Nordic countries, Sweden and Denmark in particular, have excellent services, very well structured, probably very far ahead of the rest of us. But of course, everyone there pays a lot of taxes, and the standard of living, the quality of living there, and the cost of living, rather, is very high. That's why they have these excellent services.
It just shows you how valuable Ireland is regarding to other countries.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Ireland's not bad. And in fairness, I think the UK is not bad. I think the models they use in places like Germany aren't bad either. But it's very difficult to compare because so much of it is about culture as well, and about norms and about society and about perceptions. So it's difficult to make those comparisons, I think, without really living in a few countries and experiencing not just the services, but experiencing the prejudices and experiencing all the other things around them, you know.
You think with disability it's just, oh, it's access, it's technology, but what you say, no, it's how the country looks at you.
Absolutely. It's just about living. It's about your life in this country, in a country. And obviously, if somebody with a disability, if somebody who's visually impaired or blind is moving to a new country, and moving to a new country is a big thing for anyone, it's a bigger thing for someone who's blind, you know.
Is there like trick, let's just say if someone's listening to this episode and they say, I want to head to and live in New York, is there any tricks of the trade that they can apply from their training here to go there?
If you've learned skills here, like mobility, for example, or learned to use a computer, or learned to do things, I mean, they're all transferable skills. You can bring them anywhere. And I haven't been in New York, so I don't know, but I know people who are blind and tell me that the block system over there is really easy for a blind person to navigate around. So in fact, you might have a better experience in New York than you would in Dublin, you know?
Wow. If you could gain your eyesight back tomorrow, Stuart, what would you do?
I'd probably panic because this is a kind of an interesting, I know that I would not want my eyesight back because I live what I think is a very full life as a blind person. Because I've never seen, I would have to completely relearn everything. And I think it would be a very frightening experience. If you ask somebody that question who's had their vision, of course, it's very, very different. And of course, they'd like their vision back. But the experience for me as a blind person, as a totally blind person, would be very different.
Is it just because the training and the customization of living without vision?
Yeah, but it's also the fact that I've never seen, I've no concept of what. If you think about it, I would be learning to read again. I'd be learning print letters. I'd be learning what colours are. I'd be learning faces. I'd be learning how to navigate around. I'd have to learn how to manage traffic lights. There's so many things that suddenly would be. I think the world would be very scary if I woke up tomorrow and I could see. I wouldn't know what's going on.
Do you think the scientists that are trying to discover a cure or a miracle for us to see, do you think that's a waste of time or do you think it's
absolutely not? I think it's very important. I think it's hugely important. I mean, nobody wants to be blind, and we don't want to. By the very fact that people are living longer, of course, we're going to have an older population of people with reduced vision in the future. But anything that can be done to help that, to stop that, or to deal with vision problems is welcomed. And that's where, you know, organizations like Fighting Blindness come in. They're doing great work researching and trying to develop these treatments that can help. And I think they're very important. They're personally not important to me, but they're very, very important for lots of people. And they have to be encouraged and they have to be supported.
How did your family take to not seeing?
I think for them initially it was difficult because I was the firstborn. My parents were in their early 20s, difficult experience, I think. And I think back then there wasn't the same support structures as there is now. We're going back to, again, no internet. You couldn't just reach out to people on Facebook. Very different experience, but they got through it. And I think one thing they did do was they realized that for me to get on, they need to treat me normally. And I'm very glad that they did.
Do you see yourself as a normal person fighting the struggles of human or special?
I think a normal person fighting the struggles of human. I mean, but there's always going to be special. There's always going to be things, I don't know if they're special, there's always going to be things relating to my disability that are more important to me than other people. So, you know, back to your parked cars or if something is not available electronically and someone hands it to me in a piece of paper, that requires me to have to do something with it in order to make it into something that I can read. So again, it's back to what are priorities for different parts of society. For me, obviously, I want to make sure there's no cars parked on the paths. But I hope somebody with a buggy wants to make sure there's no cars parked on the paths either. You know what I mean? It has to hit a number of parts of society.
If Google or Apple came to you and say, hey, Stuart, we want you to make a piece of technology from any your imagination, what would you make or decide to do?
I'd probably try and tweak or at least work on some stuff that's beginning to come around already, like these facial recognition glasses. That will not only do facial recognition, but that will do things like telling you, you can sit in a restaurant and read a menu, for example, use the camera on your glasses. So I'd be exploring those kind of things. I'd be looking at how that type of technology can interface with a smartphone, because I think that's really important.
What do you think of VR, virtual reality? Do you think it'd be a helpful or a hindrance for vision impairment?
I think it could be useful, but I'm virtually clueless on it, so I know very little about it. You're talking about things like Second Life, are you?
I'm more talking about the next gen kind of where you're able to watch TV through your smartphone.
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, I suppose some people are using apps like that already. For people with low vision, I'd be thinking that must be pretty handy, you know? So I think all these things that exist on a mobile platform are very, very useful.
What would be your opinion on AI, artificial intelligence? Do you think yes or no or what?
I think yes, if it can help. I think everything should be explored. I think it's good to have healthy, exploratory debate on these things and work out where, because you won't get a blanket solution for everyone, but you may get solutions through that might work for some people.
What is your favourite breakfast?
Oh, wow. I like a bowl of Weetabix sometimes in the morning, banana. And sometimes I might like a bit of, weekends, maybe a bacon sandwich or something like that.
And would that be the breakfast you'd have every day?
Oh, not a bacon sandwich every day. No, usually a bowl of Weetabix or bananas or something like that, yeah.
What would be your daily routine?
Well, I get up. I live about 25 minutes from work, so I'm usually at work for about 7:45. And it's pretty much busy right up to 5 or 5:15. By the time I get to leave the office, there's lots of stuff going on. So I'm managing a team of people and managing a service. And then I'm involved in other meetings and other things going on in the wider organization. So it's busy, and we're involved a lot with service development and planning. And, you know, it's like a lot of people who are working. Your routine, you go home, you have your dinner, and you might try to read for a while or go for a walk or do something. But, it can be busy.
Do you have any hobbies that you do
bar
technology?
Yeah, I enjoy playing music. Except before, I occasionally do a bit of swimming, enjoy walking. So yeah, and I enjoy reading. I love reading books.
What books do you like reading?
Generally thrillers, legal thrillers, psychological thrillers. I'm big into that kind of stuff.
Out of all the books you read, is there a book that you give to your friends?
Well, there are authors I would recommend. I'm reading, or have been reading at the moment, an author called Rachel Abbott. I'd highly recommend her, and she's doing a lot. She's very prolific on Twitter at the moment. She's doing a lot of stuff, and yeah, I think she's very good.
When you're reading books through Braille, can you speed read through it, or does it take slow reading?
Yeah, I tend to use Braille for work-related stuff. So I use Braille for meeting agendas. I use Braille to read reports that I need to digest. When I'm reading for leisure, it's usually audiobooks.
Do you use Audible or iTunes or Kindle?
Yeah, I'm using Audible and I use Kindle. Mainly Audible though. So I use Audible credits, and then I can get a block of books together.
Stuart, is there anything else that you would like to tell us that we haven't covered?
Not really. I mean, just to say sincerely thank you for the opportunity. The podcast you're producing sounds very exciting. If anybody obviously wants to find out more about NCBI services, you can visit us on the web at www.ncbi.ie. You can also, I'm very welcome, I'm very happy for people to contact me by email if you wish. And the address is Stuart, that's Stuart, .Lawler, and Lawler is with an E, so it's Lawler, @ncbi.ie. Very happy to correspond with anybody if they need to get in touch with me.
If they're listening to this episode and they hear, what kind of gems or services do you think they should start off with?
Well, that sort of depends on where they are in life. So I think the best thing to do is to get in touch, browse the website. I mean, one thing might be just look at our online shop, all the kind of low-tech aids for daily living that people might find useful. But really, that's very specific to the person. But I think look at the website, have a browse of the services, and then you can make contact if you want to get more information.
Fantastic, Stuart. Thank you for coming on to Partially Excited and sharing what you got to share.
Aaron, it's a pleasure. And again, a sincere thanks for the opportunity. Goodbye.
If you want to check us out, go to partiallyexcited.com. Feel free to drop Aaron O'Dowd a line about this podcast or ideas for future shows, or even if your unique story within the world of disabilities is something to tell everyone listening. We appreciate your enthusiastic support for this one-of-a-kind show.